Interview with Reverend Milton Nesvig, October 31st, 1980. Interviewer, Tom Fixell. Subject, President S.C. Eastfold. Yeah, did Dr. Eastfold ever talk to you about his early life, his family upbringing?
Well, yes, I knew Dr. Eastfold from the time I was a little boy because his father, whose name was Carl Johann Eastfold, was president of the Eastern District of the, what was called then the Norwegian Lutheran Church in America. Well, even before that, he was president of what was called the Hauge Synod. And then in 1917, that group merged to form the Norwegian Lutheran Church in America. There were three groups, the Norwegian Synod, the United Lutheran Church, and the Hauge Synod. My father and Eastfold, that is Seth Clarence Eastfold's father, were members of that Hauge, what we call the Hauge Synod. And when the new church was formed in 1917, Eastfold was president of the district, of what's called the Eastern District, with headquarters out of Chicago, and my father was secretary of the district. So Eastfold was in our home quite a bit when I was a boy growing up in Chicago from 1915 to 1922. And we moved out west. Now Seth Clarence, who became president of PLU, was born in Chicago in December 19th, 1895. And he went to college in Iowa. It's called Jewell College, which is a Hauge Synod academy, is what it was. It was a junior college, and it was located in Jewell, Iowa. And he went from there to Red Wing Seminary, and he was there for a brief period of time. And then he went on to from there to St. Olaf College, and he graduated from there in 1916. And then he went to Luther Seminary in St. Paul and graduated from there in 1920. And then he got a bachelor's degree in 1926, Bachelor of Divinity degree from Augustana Seminary in Rock Island. Did that mostly by correspondence, and also got his master's degree and doctor's degree from that school. Then he got an honorary doctorate from Luther College in 1958. He served parishes in the Midwest after he finished the seminary. He was in Partial, North Dakota from 1920 to 23, and Our Savior's in Jackson, Minnesota from 1923 to 27, Trinity in Madison, South Dakota from 1927 to 33, and then at First Lutheran in Eau Claire, Wisconsin from 1933 to 1943. Then he came to PLU as president in 43. Now he did a lot of writing and so forth during those years. He wrote a book called Immortality, which was which dealt with life after death. And he wrote a book on his dad, and then he wrote a book called Paul and Luther. The book on immortality was called Beyond the Grave. And then this book on Paul and Luther was for his doctor's thesis at Augustana.
I want to get into that, but first I was wondering, did he ever talk about his father, what kind of upbringing he had?
Yeah, he talked about his father. His father was a tall, imposing man. I remember him as a boy, seeing him. Seth Eastwood was a six-footer and very well built. Well, maybe not quite. Might have been 5'11", but he was a good-sized man. Very stocky and very strong physically. And his dad was the same type of person. His dad was a very honest, forthright person. People looked up to him. They thought very highly of him. Everybody that I've ever known thought highly of Carl J. Eastfold.
He was a pastor?
Yeah, he was a pastor. The fact that he was elected to be the district president in the new church is evidence of what they thought of him. You know, he was highly respected.
Did he talk about his family life, how that was? Did his father, did he run a tight ship?
I don't know. I wouldn't know about that. There were a lot of children in the family. Mm-hmm. He had I forget how many brothers and sisters he had, but was one who was an attorney. Carl was an attorney over in Seattle. His widow still lives over there. And then he had a sister down in California, whose husband was a member of the faculty at UCLA. And then he had a brother, Joe, who died fairly young back in Minnesota. I don't remember. Those are the ones that I remember. But I know there were quite a few in the family. And they were a happy family, and I think that would be some kind of a reflection about the type of home they came from.
Yeah. Did he talk about the influence that his father had on him?
No, he didn't. He didn't talk too much about his father. He was a type of different type of personality than his father in many respects, mm-hmm. as I recall with the father.
Yeah. How did his various congregations regard him?
Oh, he was, as far as I know, he was respected by the congregations. He was a driver. He had a tremendous ego. So he worked hard and he worked unceasingly, but he was a deep spiritual person who was concerned about the welfare of the people in his parishes. So he worked hard. He was a climber. He was a fellow who wanted to get positions of leadership. I know that he wanted to be at one time district president in the church, and he also wanted to be president of the church, but he didn't reach these goals. But of course, there have been a lot of other people who wanted these things too. But he was the type of person who let it be known that he wanted these things. He avowedly went out after these things. That's one reason why he did so well here at PLU, in getting this place out of because he was the man of the hour for PLU. We can go into that later. Sure. But because of this tremendous drive, he accomplished things. He did that in his parishes as well. His parishes all thrived under his leadership. Now, he had a lot of people that didn't like him in his parishes, too, and that's the way it's going to be with anybody who has got a lot of ambition, a lot of drive. But he was a deep spiritual man, too, and a very pious person, you call him legalistic, I say, in the sense that he hated dancing with a passion.
Why did he hate dancing?
Because he felt that he said dancing is sin to him. He gives speeches here about dancing. He said dancing, going from folk dancing to dancing is like from shifting from low into high. He said that in chapel. And he just felt it would lead to bad things. And he had that heritage from his bringing up. I don't know if it was in his home or the church, but of course the old Haugie Synod, a lot of people in the Haugie Synod were very legalistic.
Yeah.
And dancing was one of the things that was wrong. Card playing was wrong. I remember, no card playing was allowed at PLU while he was president. And no dancing was allowed here while he was president. But then on other things, he'd be quite liberal.
Mm-hmm.
But those were two things that he just didn't.
Card playing and dancing.
Yeah, he liked to play cards, but he played rook. So you didn't play use playing cards, you played rook. And he was he just loved that game. In fact, he played it with a passion and always played to win. I remember one time I played with it with Wolsett, another preacher, and I, and against him and another preacher. We beat him three straight games, and he was just wild. He just got furious because he had his partner and himself because we won. Because he had this idea that he wanted to win. But still, rook was the thing, because the cards were not playing cards, it was all right, see, to play it. Well, I was... That goes back to the early days in the church in our country, in this old, and not only Haugie Synod, but a lot of other people. You found it amongst some German groups too. They were very legalistic. Well, of course, another thing that was absolutely sin was to touch alcohol.
Mm-hmm.
No alcohol would touch his lips except in Holy Communion, and he was just anti that.
I heard that this is jumping up a bit.
Yeah.
But during his presidency, two ministers' daughters were caught drinking off campus. Do you know anything about that? I heard it caused quite an uproar.
Could very well be. Maybe it was before I came here in 47. I came in 47. I don't remember that. I remember kids that were dancing off campus were hauled in, and and disciplined. But he was, Dan, well, I won't, don't need to repeat those things.
Yeah.
But he, but that shows you that the...
Yeah, it was a very strict
down. Very strict about that, about things like that.
Mm-hmm. Who suggested Dr. Eastfold for the presidency?
Osgard, the president, J.A. Osgard, who was the president of the Lutheran, of the Norwegian Lutheran Church at that time. That's, Osgard is spelled A-S-G-A-A-R-D, and his initials were J.A. And he called up Eastfold and he says, PLU's in bad shape, it's going broke. They're 70,000 in debt, and said, or 65, whatever it was, and he said, and that was a lot of money at those times, that was back in 1943. Enrollment was down because of the war, and they had all these debts, and Osgard says, I'll give you $45,000 to go out there and settle those debts and get that place going. But if you can't make it, he says, it's no disgrace. But if you want to, if you want to go out there and be president of that school and see what you can do, why, we'll send you. And so Eastfold picked it up. He said, that's just the type of challenge he liked. And he came out here... So he came out here, and that was in the summer of 1943. And he rolled up his sleeves and went to work. And he just let the chips fall where they may. He went around, settled up accounts, and tried to get this, on these various bills that were due, he tried to cut them in half if he could. He went to all the merchants and finally got things squared away and got this thing coming on an even keel. So... then he went to work going around the congregations and seeing people and got PLU on his feet.
Oh, yeah. What were some of the ways that he raised funds for PLU?
Well,
what were some of the other ways that Dr. Eastfold worked to get PLU back on his feet?
Well, he... settle these accounts, and he did some, one of the first changes he made was to cut out the academy. See, PLU had a high school. It started out in 1894 as a high school, Pacific Lutheran Academy, and was an academy until 1920 rather. Then it became a two-year college in addition to the high school section. And then it also had in addition to having a two-year college, it had a two-year school of education, which was called a normal school. Then, so the high school continued until 1943, and then Eastfold felt that this was costing the school too much, and there weren't enough students, so they dropped the high school section and concentrated on the college, which was a four-year college at that time. So it became a four-year college in 41, and also the four-year normal program, which became 4 years in 1940. Then another thing he did was to raise funds. He went to the church, the North Pacific District. It was, in fact, at that time, it was called the Pacific District of the Evangelical Lutheran Church, which was the former Norwegian Lutheran Church. And he got permission to go around to these congregations up and down the coast. The district at that time stretched from San Diego, California, in the south to Nome, Alaska, in the north. It was a big district, and he went up and down all this area. It also included British Columbia. The district at that time was part of that. Congregations in New Westminster, Vancouver, in that area. So he went up and down talking to these people. And then he also got permission to go over into the western part of the Rocky Mountain District, which is still a part of our constituency. Over in western Montana, west of the Continental Divide. And he went to congregations there. So he went to people all over the place and asked them for money. He wasn't shy about that. And he got one device he used that was very effective was to have, in what's now called Harstad Hall, have those dormitory rooms refurbished. They were in bad shape. The buildings were in sad shape around here. So was the campus. So he got them refurbished. He'd get people to get your name on a plaque on the door. You'd pay $500 or more towards fixing up one of those rooms. So he went ahead and got the rooms refurbished on the second and third floors. There were classrooms in the middle of the second floor, but then on each end there were dormitory rooms, and then all of the third floor. And this was a co-ed dorm. So PLU was a co-ed, had a co-ed dorm from its very inception. Yes. People don't realize that, but it was. I lived in there. See, the north, the south end of Harstead Hall on the second and third floors was men's dorm, and the north end was girls, and there was partitions in between. In fact, there was a big locked partition at the top of, on the third floor there. It was never open. No door even, just a big partition there. And on the second floor, of course, there were doors at each end because there were classrooms in between. Well, so he fixed up those rooms. Then he had a project to finish the fourth floor and the fifth floor. That was all completed by about 1948, about 49. And then also fixed up the basement where the cafeteria was located, where the students ate. And that was the cafeteria for the university until 1960. Oh, it was about, 1958, I think it was, when Ada Ingram Hall was built. Okay, 58, 59, somewhere in there. Anyway, he saw that building got all refurbished and fixed up, put in, conducted drives to get money to fix up that building. And also, there were other buildings that were built during his era, in 1946, the old gymnasium, which is located where the University Center is now, that building burned to the ground one night. And so he appealed to the city of Tacoma and to the constituents all over for money to replace that building and build a student union building on the foundation of the building that was down. And at the same time, started a project to build a science hall, and that was completed in 47, and then also he had a project to build Memorial Gymnasium. And a fellow by the name of H.S. Baker here in Tacoma gave $100,000 towards that building, towards Memorial Gymnasium, which was also built. So there were three buildings that went up in the 46, 47, and they were all dedicated. Let's see, the University Center, the Student Union was open in the fall of 47 and dedicated at homecoming time, and I was the first manager of that building. That was one of my jobs in addition to everything else. I came in the fall of 47. And then the Science Hall was dedicated in November, and in December, Memorial Gymnasium was dedicated and used. PLU played the University of Washington in that game, I remember, and Dr. Allen, who was president of the university at that time, gave the dedicatory address. Well, then Eastfold also started a drive to build a chapel. That's one thing he wanted, to have chapel on the campus, a chapel itself, chapel building. And so, because chapel from 47 and on was held in Memorial Gymnasium. Chapel, and he wanted compulsory chapel, and he couldn't very well enforce it way down there. So in 51, the chapel was started, and it was completed in 1952, and dedicated in May of 52, and in the fall of 53, chapel was begun. That is a compulsory chapel was initiated.
What was his argument for compulsory chapel?
He felt that this was an important part of the student life, and he felt that everyone should go to chapel. It's the only it was maybe something from his days at Red Wing Seminary or Jewell College. I don't know. St. Olaf College, it wasn't compulsory. I went to St. Olaf, and but of course it was compulsory in the sense that if you didn't go away, you heard about it. But here at PLU, Eastfold just felt that this was one of the important things in the life of the student and the faculty and staff, and everybody went to chapel. Everything closed up around this place, and chapel was for all.
What happened to those who didn't go to chapel who tried to stay in their dorm rooms?
Well, roll was taken, and if a person missed three or more, then they were called in for a consultation. And if they insisted on staying away from chapel, disciplinary action was threatened. I don't know of any student who was, they were threatened with expulsion, but I don't know of any student that was expelled for not attending chapel. Usually they came around and they'd go there, but they weren't too happy about it. You know. But for the most part, the students went along with this thing.
Was chapel every day, or was it like this now, Monday, Wednesday?
Chapel was every day except Tuesday, which was student body day, and student body day was not compulsory. They could come. That was conducted by the student body president, and they could do whatever they wanted. They usually had business meetings, or sometimes they'd have other things going on, lectures and so forth.
Now, mandatory chapel was instituted in 52?
Yes. And well, yeah, in the spring of 52, when in May of 52, in the fall of 52, it went in.
Mm-hmm.
And Eastvoll used to conduct chapel when he was here. Otherwise, Dean Haugie or someone else would conduct it. And Eastvoll would always usually speak on Fridays. He'd have the chapel talk.
What was a favorite theme of his?
Well, when he'd say, on Friday, when he'd give his announcements, he'd always give the announcements before his speech. And he'd always say, well, it's been a good week. That was, of course, well, regardless of what had happened during the week, it's always a good week. And that was a cliche around here. And then he was quite, he had this expression about, he was always talking about, if the Lord tarries. When Judgment Day doesn't come, why, we'll do this and we'll do that. And then he also had another that expression about he who was the owner of the cattle on 1,000 hillsides, quoting the Old Testament. And he, he had other things in his speeches. He'd tell about his experiences, he'd tell about the people he met out in the field and so forth and so on. He was very folksy and very warm and that type of thing. And if anything got up under his skin, well, then of course he'd get in there and talk about things. I remember a couple of things. One was in when he wanted the student congregation, and when he got to chapel, he wanted the student congregation. There was a lot of opposition to this. See, this was one of the first things, first places where a student congregation was had in our colleges in America. St. Olaf, I think, started about the same time. And he wanted this one here because everything that St. Olaf had, he wanted here. Because that was kind of his goal, his ideal as a college. And St. Olaf, of course, was a great school. Well, anyway, so we got this, he went and had a meeting. He had a committee set up and with people in the faculty and student body and so forth, and the board. We're going to have a student congregation. Well, it was quite a battle, but it went through. Then he, in chapel the next day, he announced with pride, he says, it was passed unanimously last night that we were going to have a student congregation. And one of the faculty members, his name was Dr. Magnus Notvedt, who was opposed to this thing, he says, he couldn't contain himself, and he says, no, it was not unanimous. And Eastvoll looked at him, he says, it was unanimous.
Yeah.
And another time we had a lot of students in the late 50s, I think it was around 56, 57, they wanted to have some popular entertainment on campus, you know. So they came and they had consulted with several of us in the faculty and staff around here what could be good. And an outfit that was popular at the time was called the Four Freshmen. Now you've probably heard of them.
Mm-hmm.
And they were engaged to come. And they just packed the place. And the students, this was the first time we'd had any popular music group, because Eastwell didn't like jazz. Well, he sat there, I remember, he sat up there in the front row, and I was fairly close to him, and he was just irritated. Man, it just drove him wild. And these guys were tame, you know? you know, the four freshmen is fairly tame. Their jokes were without reproach, and everything was, it was high class entertainment, but popular music.
Mm-hmm.
And Stevers, the next morning, he gets up there in chapel, he says, "The devil walked on this stage last night, but by George, he's not coming here again."
Did he keep all the jazz groups out till he...
Well, but they had to be very careful. But he said the devil walked on stage, and, oh, jeepers. He just, to him, this was sin, you know. Popular music, that was jazz stuff, and that was associated with dancing, and this was sin. So
was there any truth to the comment that he once said that if there's ever any jazz played on the campus, he would break up the band and sell the instruments?
I don't know that if he said that or not. I've heard rumors to that effect, but I never heard it, and I didn't hear about it. You might ask Gilbertson. He might know something about that.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, he was. He liked band music, and the band boy, whatever they needed, he'd get for them, because he liked like pieces like Stars and Stripes Forever and so forth. Because he played in a band when he was in at Red Wing, and I think at Saint Olaf too.
Mm-hmm. Was Red Wing a very conservative school?
Yes, it was very conservative. It was of the old Hoggy Synod, and it was. Yeah, my father went there, and so I know pretty much about that school and about a lot of the people connected with that.
Oh, yeah. Did he ever have any trouble recruiting students to come to the university, especially with his restrictions on the social?
Oh, yeah, that had some effect, I imagine, and also other effects, that the fact that the school was small and struggling and didn't have too good a name, academically or from the standpoint of his physical plan. We had a lot of good teachers around here, but we just didn't have the name. We had a couple hundred students around here, and 150 he had during those war years. But then one thing, he went to work and got a physical plant. He saw that he had to have a physical plant, and he had to get faculty. So he went out in 47. I know he got a lot of real good additions to the faculty and worked hard at getting PhD people and paying them. Another thing he did was... didn't have big salaries, but he always saw to it that the faculty was paid and looked after that and was conscientious about that. So over a period of years, this thing was built up and confidence in the university, but it took many years because PLU didn't have a name as a good, we didn't have a good physical plant, we didn't have a name as a strong academic institution. And we still have a ways to go, but we're getting there, you know. But he was a man who worked hard to see to it that we got academic respectability. He was not an academician. He was a development and a promoter and a fundraiser, that type of a person. He related well to the church, but when it came to the big business and things of that nature, he didn't relate to them too well. He was on a speaking acquaintance with him, but he was not in their league.
Yeah. I take it he got along very well with the Lutheran Church, the ALC?
Yes, he was respected in the church. He wanted to be president of the church when Fred Schutz was elected back in the 50s, and I think it was 56, if I remember correctly. Somewhere's in there. But he didn't make it. He was nominated, but... He emerged as the type of person that they wanted as their leader, and so he didn't make it. That's no disgrace. There's a lot of people who've been chosen who want to be in these positions, but he for certain reasons he just didn't make it.
Yeah, I heard that. There was there was some question over an investment he made at Ocean Shores.
Yeah, that was one of the big scandals that we had here at the PLU back in 1960, 61. That was a sad chapter. I'll tell you a little bit about it. can't go into all the details, but because that'd take me an hour and a half. But it was an investment. You see, we got about 1960 or somewhere in there, the Ford Foundation gave millions of dollars to all private colleges and universities in the United States, and we got $250,000. And that money was to be invested and to help towards programs at schools. Well, he got the board to put that money into a place called Ocean Shores, down on, which still exists today. It was real estate development. And his son was connected with this. His son Donald, who had been Attorney General of the State of Washington from 1952 to 56, and then ran for governor and was defeated. So he was out of public office in 56. He'd gone into real estate development up on Whidbey Island and down at Ocean Shores. So Don got him to put his father got the board to put that money into Ocean Shores. And then a big story came out in the newspapers, the Seattle Times broke it and appeared in the papers all over the Northwest, about how this Ocean Shores came about, and the fact that PLU had invested monies in it. You can look at the files on it if you want to, the story that I've got it down in my office. It was a legal thing that was done, but it was a little shady when it came to how Ocean Shores came about, and then we were made a part of it. So a big hue and cry went up over this from all directions, from the public and from our church people and from our constituency and so forth. Mm-hmm. So the result was that we got out of this thing,
yeah,
and got our money back. They paid the money back with good interest. You know, but had a big investigation by the board of the activities of the president at that time, of Dr. Eastfield. And it's kind of a sad chapter.
Yeah.
But it,
I heard that Flieger and Foss were built on variations of blueprints that were intended for buildings to be constructed or Ocean Shores?
No.
All of that?
No, that's not true.
Mm-hmm.
The one that was built by an Ocean Shores contractor is Delta Hall.
That's Delta.
And the fellow who built that was a man who had also built similar units down at Ocean Shores, motel units,
mm-hmm,
and came up here and built that one.
Oh, yeah. But
Foss and Flieger, no, they were designed by Richards here in Tacoma, Richards Architects.
Yeah.
John Richards, who lives right down below the hill here, and that White House just below the University Center, was the architect. He designed University Center. No, I mean, he designed the old Student Union, which was raised in 1969 to make room for the present University Center. He designed that building. He designed the Science Hall. And in addition to the Science Hall, he designed the University Gymnasium, that is Memorial Gymnasium. And he designed Flieger and Foss, Kreidler, Hinderly, and Hong Halls, and then also, and the member of his, and his father designed Xavier Hall, and the other building there was designed by, that is the two, Stuhl and Ordahl were designed by the firm of Richards.
Mm-hmm.
Lee Pearson Richards is the name of the architectural firm.
Oh, okay.
So, no, that's strictly rumor.
That's strictly rumor.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. I was wondering, how did, this is on a whole different subject, how did he get along with the local community, the Parkland residents?
Well, he went pretty good here in Parkland, you know. He was not too close to any of them.
Mm-hmm.
He was so busy with what he was doing at the school that he wasn't active in local affairs. He was a member of the Kiwanis Club downtown. But he was gone so much he didn't attend too regularly. He was not too active in civic affairs. We were members of the Chamber of Commerce, and he attended some of those meetings and so forth. He had some relationships with downtown, but not in the not to the extent that subsequent presidents have had.
Yeah. What? Let's see. What was the students' view of him? How did they regard him?
Well, it was mixed emotions.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them swore by him, others swore at him. You know.
Either or.
You're either or. Yeah. And others just thought the world of him, didn't agree with him, but just went along with it. You know, they said, mm-hmm. it's kind of smile about things. There were some who were radically opposed to him.
What do you think the biggest source of conflict was with him?
Basically, his legalism.
Mm-hmm.
That was the biggest thing. And the fact that he was a steamroller type of fellow, and his way had to prevail. And this is not in criticism. This is just, I'm trying to be objective here.
Sure.
As I worked with that man for, let's see, from 47 to 62. So that's 15 years.
Yeah.
And he was a good friend. We got along fine, except we have our differences too. And I didn't agree with him on a lot of things. And towards the last, of course, I don't feel that he was in his right mind his last couple of years around here.
How so?
He was irrational in his actions. So many things that were counter to what a normal person would do.
Yeah.
And he saw things had to change because he was the type of fellow that when he was here, he ran this place, he was of the old school.
Mm-hmm.
Like Thompson was over at UPS and like Lars Bo was at Sinolf. They were fellows that ran the institutions out of their vest pocket, and they weren't used to consulting with people. What they did, that was it.
Mm-hmm.
That era disappeared in the late 50s and early 60s.
So do you think that by the last couple of years that he had more or less outlived his beliefs? Mm-hmm. I mean, in terms of mandatory chapel and the entertainments?
Yeah. Those things were changing, and there was opposition in a lot of areas. The faculty was split down the middle, and we had some pretty rough goes around here.
What was the split over? Just the way
the way things were being run here. Yeah.
Hmm.
So that's a long, long story.
Yeah.
We love the man and for what he'd done for the school and so forth. And in retrospect, you look back and you see those last couple of years he was here as chaotic years when the roof kind of came down around him and the house of cards just kind of fell down around him.
Mm-hmm. I think there's a lot of opposition.
There was a lot of opposition, especially to his policies.
Yeah. What do you think his most important contribution?
Well, like I've mentioned these things now,
sure.
The fact that he's got this place on his feet.
Yeah.
It was ready to go down into the... Well, they were ready to close it. And he came out here and he just rolled up his sleeves and went to work. And let the chips fall where they made. And he just went, just waded in and did the job that had to be done. And so people respected him for it. He got this thing back on an even keel, and got buildings and got the place rolling. So that's his contribution. And also another contribution he made in 1960 when we became a university. He insisted that he wanted PLU to become a university. That split the faculty, but his way prevailed, and I think it was a smart move. In fact, that's what made PLU. That's one of his greatest contributions, I think, was the fact that he insisted that we become a university. A lot of people said we weren't ready to become a university, but you're never ready to become anything, you know.
Yeah.
You've got to go ahead and assert yourself. That's where his strength lay. He just waded in and said, this is the way it's going to be. Same way the student congregation, a lot of opposition, but that religious program has been one of the strengths of this university. And the student congregation has been a good force in the spiritual life of the school. So there's another contribution that he made.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Well, thank you very much.
Okay, you bet.